Good evening. Dozens of protesters killed in Bolivia. The government has been seized by right-wing evangelical Christians. Adam Schiff is no progressive, and the many tentacles of Joe Biden's empire. With these and other stories, I'm Paul Durienza with the WBAI News for Wednesday, November 20th, 2019. Britain's Prince Andrew stepped down from public duties on Wednesday, saying the controversy surrounding his ill-judged association with late U.S. financier Jeffrey Epstein had caused major disruption to the royal family's work. Andrew, Queen Elizabeth's second son, denies an allegation that he had sex with a 17-year-old girl procured for him by his friend Epstein. The scandal has escalated since Andrew's rambling explanations in a disastrous BBC TV interview aired on Saturday. He said he would step down from public life for the time being and speak to police about Epstein. Some protesters trapped inside a Hong Kong university on Wednesday tried to flee through the sewers, where one student said she saw snakes, but firemen prevented further escape bids by blocking a manhole into the system. Fewer than 100 protesters remained inside the Polytechnic University, ring-fenced 24 hours a day by riot police, after more than 1,000 were arrested from late on Monday. Some surrendered while others were held during escape attempts that included trying to clamber down ropes to weighty motorbikes on Monday night. Some protesters threw petrol bombs and police responded with tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannon. The unrest marks the most serious popular challenge to Chinese President Xi Jinping since he came to power in 2012. And in Bolivia, ousted Bolivian President Evo Morales is calling for the United Nations to denounce and stop the massacre of indigenous Bolivians by the dictatorship. Morales charged that 30 people have already been killed. Tweeting from Mexico, where he was given political asylum after being forced to resign by the Bolivian military on November 10th, Morales described the current authorities as the dictatorship of Añez, Camacho, and Meza, referring to the self-proclaimed interim president and opposition leader who lost the election to him last month. There have been multiple reports of indigenous Bolivians who took to the streets being fired upon by the police and the military loyal to the opposition, Senator Jeanine Añez, who declared herself the interim president. WBAI producer and Code Pink activist Medea Benjamin is in La Paz, the capital city of Bolivia. She told WBAI she's seen the bloody aftermath of the fighting.
This government that has taken over in Bolivia is really a right-wing fascist coup government. Since they took over, they have unleashed the military against the people. They've enacted a decree saying that the military and police would not be held responsible for any acts that they do against the people. This has unleashed a wave of violence, including a massacre near Cochabamba and then another massacre near La Paz that happened yesterday that we were witness to.
Tell me what you saw.
There is a very organized opposition to this government, and they are blockading streets and highways. The main road that links La Paz to the other cities has been blockaded by people opposed to the government. And they have also set up a blockade outside the main plant that provides gas for cooking as well as gasoline to the entire city of La Paz. And so there have been tremendous shortages of gas. There also are shortages of food. So the army yesterday decided that by force they would break this peaceful blockade, which they did, firing first tear gas and then live bullets into the crowd. We know already confirmed 8 dead, and there might be more. People are accusing the military of having taken some of the bodies, and the people are outraged. They feel like they have this new government that is fanatically Christian, came in with an oversized Bible, literally, and said, God will now be in the presidential headquarters and not the Wipala, the flag of the indigenous people. They also have repressed a vigil down here in La Paz that was full of indigenous people and their families, totally peaceful. They were going to sleep the night here in protest of this new government, and the police and military came in to break that up with tear gas. The repression is brutal, and people are determined to fight even more. So the divisions in this country right now, something that had been dealt with very well by Evo Morales, divisions between race and class have now come to the fore in a terrible way. And I fear that there's going to be more violence because the indigenous people are determined to get rid of this government.
Did you see the gunfire?
We didn't see the gunfire, but as soon as we got there, we saw the bullets and the wounded. And we went into the clinics and the hospital and the churches and saw the bodies. And they showed us with bullets in their back and bullets through the head. They said they were snipers as well. Today, we were in the church where they had the dead bodies and the families there, and then they had a big open air town hall with thousands of people speaking about what they're going to do to demand accountability. And of course, number one is the end of this government. And it's important to understand that this government was supposed to be an interim government just to call for new elections, and instead it's turned this country upside down. It has taken out all of the ministers, Morales' government, and put in new ministers. It has done new legislation, such as the one that gives the military the right to shoot the people. It has taken over all of the state media so that now anything you turn on is just pure propaganda that doesn't cover at all what's really happening here. They've broken relations with Venezuela, sent home over 700 Cuban doctors, and made favorable relations with the right-wing governments in Latin America. And people don't think that this government is ever going to turn over power. They don't trust it at all. They don't think they would oversee free and fair elections. So they're calling for a technocratic, non-political interim group that would really hold free and fair elections.
WBAI producer and Code Pink activist Medea Benjamin reporting from La Paz, the capital city of Bolivia. Today, Añez said she would call for a new general election soon. And in Europe, the chief prosecutor of Ukraine has widened an investigation into the founder of energy company Burisma to include suspicion of embezzling state funds. Allegations of wrongdoing at Burisma go to the heart of the impeachment inquiry into whether President Donald Trump improperly pressured Ukraine's leadership to investigate his main rival in the 2020 presidential race. Trump wants Ukraine to launch an investigation into former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter, who is a board member of Burisma from 2014 to 2019. We'll have more on the ties between the Biden family and Ukraine after this report.
I'm Jesse Lent with WBAI's Impeachment Watch. Today's public impeachment hearing before the House Intelligence Committee produced the most significant testimony yet, as U.S. Ambassador to the European Union Gordon Sondland admitted under oath that President Trump did indeed propose a quid pro quo, or in other words, a bribe, in return for the U.S. government releasing nearly $400 million of military aid to help Ukraine deter Russian aggression at the country's border.
As I testified previously, Mr. Giuliani's requests were a quid pro quo for arranging a White House visit for President Zelensky. Mr. Giuliani demanded that Ukraine make a public statement announcing the investigations of the 2016 election, DNC server, and Burisma. Mr. Giuliani was expressing the desires of the President of the United States, and we knew these investigations were important to the president. In July and August of 2019, we learned that the White House had also suspended security aid to Ukraine. I was adamantly opposed to any suspension of aid. As the Ukrainians needed those funds to fight against Russian aggression. I tried diligently to ask why the aid was suspended, but I never received a clear answer. Still haven't to this day. In the absence of any credible explanation for the suspension of aid, I later came to believe that the resumption of security aid would not occur until there was a public statement from Ukraine committing to the investigations of the 2016 elections and Burisma, as Mr. Giuliani had demanded.
The other big takeaway from Sondland's testimony on Wednesday was how many top officials were in on this alleged quid pro quo between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine, or at least knew about it.
Within my State Department emails, there is a July 19th email. This email was sent to Secretary Pompeo, Secretary Perry, Brian McCormick, who is Secretary Perry's chief of staff at the time, Ms. Kenna, who is the executive secretariat for Secretary Pompeo, Chief of Staff Mulvaney, and Mr. Mulvaney's senior advisor, Rob Blair. A lot of senior officials. Here is my exact quote from that email. I talked to Zelensky just now. He is prepared to receive POTUS's call. We'll assure him that he intends to run a fully transparent investigation and will turn over every stone. He would greatly appreciate a call prior to Sunday so that he can put out some media about a friendly and productive call, no details, prior to Ukraine election on Sunday. Chief of Staff Mulvaney responded, I asked the NSC to set it up for tomorrow. Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th, days before the presidential call.
President Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and Energy Secretary Rick Perry all released statements disputing parts of Sondland's testimony and attempting to distance themselves from him. While Rudy Giuliani released a statement following Sondland's testimony that he was simply offering his opinion in matters relating to Ukraine and that no one was required to follow his orders. House Republicans, for their part in the hearing, looked to emphasize that President Trump never specifically told Ambassador Sondland to hold up the aid to Ukraine or about any other specific favor he wanted. Congressman Jim Jordan echoed Trump's own comments from earlier today at a press conference on the White House lawn, where the commander-in-chief referenced a phone call he had with Ambassador Sondland back in September, in which he said he wanted, quote, nothing from the president of Ukraine.
The president says, let me read it one more time. What do you want from Ukraine, Mr. President? I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. I want this new guy, brand new guy in politics. His party just took over. I want Zelensky to do the right thing. I want him to run on and do what he ran on, which is deal with corruption. And you can't find time to fit that in a 23-page opening statement. You know what a quid pro quo is?
I do.
This for that? Right? Looks to me like Ukraine got that three times, and we didn't do anything.
For the WBAI Evening News, this has been Impeachment Watch. I'm Jesse Lent.
Thanks, Jesse. Former Vice President Joe Biden was senator from Delaware for 36 years before he won the vice presidency on Barack Obama's ticket. According to Philadelphia Inquirer staff writer Joe DiStefano, during that time, Biden and his family perfected the Delaware way, a bipartisan contrast to national politics. In his role as a senior senator, Biden set up businesses that profited his family members and established businesses investments in Ukraine, China, and Africa. DiStefano's article, Joe Biden's Friends and Backers Come Out on Top at the Expense of the Middle Class, is in The Nation.
What is demonstrated in the story is that really over a period of 45 years, his family has been approached by a relentless parade of business people. He's frequently worked with those business people, both individually, his brothers and sons, and himself on a legislative basis at issues that were important to them. A large part of this in Delaware is that when you are elected to public office in this country, you end up representing the big employers in your state. That's what's handed to you, whether you like it or not. And if you want to keep your job, very often you find it to your advantage to help those employers. And for a very long period of Joe Biden's time in the Senate, he was a defender of the banks, and in particular the credit card banks, Delaware being the credit card company, capital of America, due to laws that were changed while he was in the U.S. Senate, both at the federal level and at the state level. They basically took away consumer protections. They put in place regressive income taxes, that the more money the banks made, the lower tax rate they had to pay. And Mr. Biden's end of that was very often being one of the handful of Democrats who gave the Republicans a majority so that they could make it more difficult for people who were broke because they had borrowed too much money to force them to repay that money.
About Ukraine, Hyansky, you mentioned all his foreign connections, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but it seems like some of these companies were involved in some unusual dealings.
In fact, the United States was very interested in businesses going over to Ukraine and doing business in Ukraine right after the breakup of the Soviet Union, and John Hyansky was a pioneer. He was born, I believe it was in Germany, as a refugee from the Soviets right after World War II. Came to Delaware, did a lot better in the car business than Joe Biden's father did, ended up owning a bunch of dealerships. Was suggested by Ford that he go over to Ukraine in the 90s and start a dealership there, which he started an import business. That did well. He started a dealership. Well, there were a lot of problems with business in the Ukraine in the 90s. The U.S. stopped a popular subsidy that had gone to a lot of companies that did business there, OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which made loans where banks would not to American companies that were active overseas. Well, when Joe Biden got elected vice president, several months later he went to Ukraine. John Hyansky went along and was in some of the same venues, and Joe Biden called attention to the people there that his friend John Hyansky was in the crowd building a car business in Ukraine. And immediately, very shortly after, OPIC lifted its ban and started funding businesses that were going into Ukraine. One of the first was Hyansky's, first for $2.5 million, a few years later for $20 million. He used that money to build not more Ford dealerships, but to add to that other car brands that were built in Europe. Porsches, there were Bentleys, there were Land Rovers and Jaguars. And he's done very well with that, and he's paying his loan on time. There's a number of favors that have been done for companies that have ties to the Bidens that Mr. Hyansky has done, or to individuals, such as Mr. Biden's brother, needed a $500,000 loan, house he had down in Florida that was just about wiped out in a hurricane, and helped him get out of that. There's a stock exchange in Delaware that is backed by public money. It's doing very poorly. Mr. Hyansky came into that as an investor as well, and his fellow investors include a company whose vice chairman is the son of the head of Mr. Trump's main super PAC, which is Linda McMahon's son, Shane McMahon, from the wrestling family. So there's all kinds of combinations here. There's all kinds of relationships. They're not necessarily illegal. Nobody has accused these folks of stealing money from the people. It's just a very tight group in some respects. It's also a very fluid group in other respects. But that is where Mr. Biden and his family reside. That's where they do business. Some of these companies do well. Some of them do poorly. There are other companies that have invested with the Bidens and have very little to show for it. And over in China, there are, as you pointed out, a company that included not only Hunter Biden, but a number of other prominent young Democrats that ended up investing with Chinese private and Chinese government-controlled companies in some very sensitive businesses around the world. One of the largest cobalt and copper mines in Africa, a company making security technology that has been accused of using it against the Uyghurs and other minorities in China. So quite a few companies that it would be very hard to see the investment happen today that in the middle 2010s under the Biden and Obama administration, those investments were being made by American companies, and the company Hunter Biden was part of was at the very forefront of that effort.
The implication is that he's not the man of the common person at all, and that any attempts to show he's a man of the working class and what have you might be a bit foolish.
His roots are arguably in the working class. Actually, his father did very well as a war contractor during World War II, and his uncle did poorly after the war and really had to work their way back into their social position. But, you know, you can say his roots are in the middle class, but like a lot of families in America, go back to Benjamin Franklin. When he was named clerk to the province of Pennsylvania, rejoiced that he could get the province's printing business into his own press. And this is a very old story in America. The Bidens didn't start it, but they certainly benefited from it. The one child of the Bidens who really looked for a while like he was going out and using his foundation to make something of an independent career, Beau Biden, who was the Delaware Attorney General and who took some positions that were really farther against the banks and critical of the banks during the Great Recession than his father had ever taken, unfortunately died young, so we don't really know where he would have gone with that. Many other people in the family, their careers seem to exist in the shadow of and often with the advantage of their father's connections, their father's prominence.
Inquirer. Meanwhile, a spokesman for Biden on Thursday said that U.S. President Donald Trump was desperately clutching for conspiracy theories that have been debunked and dismissed by independent, credible news organizations. Hours earlier, Trump told reporters that he wanted Ukraine and China to investigate Biden and his son, businessman Hunter Biden, a public request echoing the appeal he made in a phone call on July 25th with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that led to an impeachment inquiry by the House of Representatives. Amid the din of public impeachment hearings, Democratic presidential candidates are gathering tonight in Atlanta to debate once again. This round also comes less than 3 months before the first primaries and caucuses. 10 candidates made the cut, down from a record of 12 in October's debate. MSNBC and The Washington Post are hosting the debate, which is scheduled to start at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and last for 2 hours. Two candidates who debated in October will not be on stage this time. Former Housing Secretary Julian Castro did not reach the threshold, and former Texas Representative Beto O'Rourke has dropped out of the race. Peace activist David Swanson is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He is executive director of WorldBeyondWar.org and campaign coordinator for RootsAction.org. He says the problem with the impeachment hearings is that the Democrats are trying to make Joe Biden look good, not expose Trump's real crimes.
When you look at the Democratic so-called leadership and ask what are they trying to get out of this, it's clearly not motivated by trying to stop all the damage Trump is doing or remove him and his vice president from office. It's clearly not motivated by trying to simply fulfill their oath of office and do their job. Trump would have been impeached for numerous indisputable public acts months or years ago if those were the motivations. I think the motivations are very clearly to make Trump look bad, but keep him in his job, to make Joe Biden look good, even if they may end up having the opposite effect. That's the intention. And to blame Russia for the 2016 election, which is, of course, ludicrous. But that's the way that this party leadership thinks. That's what they're about here.
What's going on? What use is impeachment being put to historically up till now?
There have been more impeachment efforts and articles of impeachment introduced by courageous and principled Congress members than were ever told about. You know, there was a significant movement to impeach Harry Truman, for example, that won the reforms or helped win the reforms it was after, short of getting to impeachment. With George W. Bush, of course, you had popularity for impeachment as high or roughly as high as it's been for Trump in the absence of any movement in Congress or any support in the corporate media, and you had a long list of indisputable outrages for which he could have been impeached, and you had Nancy Pelosi and then Judiciary Chair John Conyers stating very clearly that they preferred to focus on the upcoming election and that that was more important, and by implication that they thought people would be more likely to vote for Democrats who rolled over and took it than who stood up and did their jobs.
What do you think this is going to lead in the end?
I'm not good at predicting. I prefer advocating, but I would say if the impeachment focuses solely on Ukraine, even if it passes the House, I don't think it is a strong motivator for a conviction in the Senate, and I think that that's the goal. If the public rises up in a new, unexpected way and demands that the U.S. Congress impeach Donald Trump for some of his greater outrages, as you were mentioning, there's always a list of greater outrages, the corruption, the emoluments violations. If you go to RootsAction.org, you can read 25 articles of impeachment we've drafted on incitement to violence, on interference with voting rights, discrimination on the basis of religion, illegal wars, illegal threats of nuclear wars, abuse of the pardon power, including again just this week, and on and on. Well, then I think you're more likely to get a conviction in the Senate and to set a better precedent. Then we're looking at actually the removal of Donald Trump from office earlier and an end to his outrages and abuses and a precedent set for whoever replaces him, including perhaps Mike Pence temporarily, that they can't do the same thing.
David Swanson is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He's executive director of WorldBeyondWar.org and campaign coordinator for RootsAction.org. President Trump had this to say on the impeachment hearings on the White House grounds as he was about to board his helicopter today.
Just a quick comment on what's going on in terms of testimony with Ambassador Sondland. And I just noticed one thing, and I would say that means it's all over. What do you want from Ukraine? He asks me, screaming. What do you want from Ukraine? I keep hearing all these different ideas and theories. This is Ambassador Sondland speaking to me. Just happened. To which I turned off the television. What do you want from Ukraine? I keep hearing all these different ideas and theories. What do you want? What do you want? It was a very short and abrupt conversation that he had with me. They said he was not in a good mood. I'm always in a good mood. I don't know what that is. He just said, now he's talking about what my response. So he's going, what do you want? What do you want? I hear all these theories. What do you want? Right? And now, here's my response that he gave. Just gave. Ready? You have the cameras rolling? I want nothing. That's what I want from Ukraine. That's what I said. I want nothing. I said it twice. So he goes, he asked me the question, what do you want? I keep hearing all these things. What do you want? He finally gets me. I don't know him very well. I have not spoken to him much. This is not a man I know well. Seems like a nice guy, though. But I don't know him well. He was with other candidates. He actually supported other candidates. Not me. Came in late. But here's my response. Now, if you weren't fake news, you'd cover it properly. I say to the ambassador in response, I want nothing. I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky, President Zelensky, to do the right thing. So here's my answer. I want nothing. I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky to do the right thing. Then he says, this is the final word from the President of the United States. I want nothing. Thank you, folks. Have a good time. I'm going to Texas.
And that's some of the news for Wednesday, November 20th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Jesse Lent. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From the studios of the listener-sponsored, locally produced, and independent WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.